Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. Well, first up, we have an interview with Joe Sikora. He's written a book called Defying Gravity. This tells a personal account of how, as a young man, he went to Hollywood in hopes of becoming a famous actor, but God had tremendously other plans for him. So stay tuned for that. And following that, we have an interview with George Weigel, the author of the new book, The Fragility of Order. So we'll bring you those interviews right now. Good morning. This morning we're joined by author Joe Sikora. He's written a book called Defying Gravity, and this is a personal story about how he chose joy and lifted his family from death to life. Welcome, Joe.
Oh, so good to be with you, Barbara. Thank you so much.
You know, this book is so relevant. I'm so grateful that you wrote it. I mean, so many people often go through tragic things in life, and they just don't have the wherewithal to write about them and to help other people see through them. And we live in a culture that if you get some sort of diagnosis about your health, we immediately think this is too much, euthanasia, or even the hospitals, it's too much money to take care of these children. Talk a little bit about your story and why this is such a wrong attitude about life.
Well, that's a great question. And I would say for us, because certainly, you know, people could say, well, what does this cost? But what we really miss is the human cost. We think when we're given a diagnosis, and for me, of course, it was very personal. Both of my kids were diagnosed with this very rare, incurable genetic disease. And what you think in terms of human cost is, I can't do this. There's going to be no joy. There's going to be no love or laughter or peace in my life. And we seriously underestimate, I would say, ourselves, or probably more accurately, the power of God, that when God enters into our life, when we invite him into the midst of our struggle, we find so much more than we thought we were capable of. And that was my experience, you know, it's you know, that we found this love, and we didn't anticipate that. We didn't think that would happen. And so that's really what people don't expect. You know, it's like, well, if this child of mine has a disease, or if I have some kind of disease, my life is gone. And that's just not how God operates.
Yeah, and that's so important to point out. And I think in the book you point out just taking every day as it comes. That was advice from your father-in-law when your wife got married to you, and she was nervous about it. Well, let's go back a little bit. Talk a little bit about your life. You were somebody who aspired to be an actor and married a woman who was a nurse, became a nurse, and you thought you know, living in California, living out your dream. Take it from there.
Yeah, I thought I knew from very young what it was I was called to do. I mean, I really felt like it was a call that, you know, I had these natural gifts and talents as an actor, or at least I thought I did. Maybe I wasn't as good as I thought. But, I really lived out pursuing that dream. It's what I loved. And what I discovered, you know, I married Lori, my high school sweetheart, and that was certainly part of my dream. I that was probably, of course, the biggest blessing in my life. But I really discovered, you know, that, you know, our best laid plans are not necessarily God's plans for us. And I had to, you know, when our kids were given this diagnosis, you know, at the same time, you know, my career was kind of floundering, my acting career. And I had to let go of everything that I dreamed of, everything I had hoped for, because, of course, there was no more devastating dream. It was a nightmare when my boys were diagnosed with this disease. And I it was a very slow process, but I just had to relinquish control of what it is I wanted for me in my life. But what I found is that God had so much more in store, you know, so I could let it go. But it's hard, you know, it's hard to let go of what we want selfishly and say, okay, God, I trust you completely. But that was really the process. And as I did that, as I let go of what I wanted and just sort of opened myself to what God wanted for me, I found so much more than I could ever dream of. So it was a difficult journey, but, you know, and it goes on still today. I still have plans that go, oh, this would be great, God. And it doesn't work out that way, but that's life.
Yeah, exactly. We're speaking with Joe Sikora. The book is called Defying Gravity, How Choosing Joy Lifted My Family from Death to Life. We should go into a little more detail about this diagnosis. And this is something that most people would just really, find impossible to cope with. You had a child at age 7, and 3 years later, another son at age 4, and you found out pretty soon within those years that they both had this disease. And you talk very poignantly in the book about going to find out more about this and going to, he had Batten's disease and a national symposium on this disease. And when you walked in and you saw these kids that you knew were going to be your future, the way they were debilitated, you went back to the hotel and cried. I think many people would stay there. Why me? Get angry at God. We see so much in the news now that people can have assisted suicide. Why would I let my child suffer through that? This is just such a common visceral reaction. And you're here to say there is so much joy and so much hope in not going that route.
Yeah, I'll remember that day till the day I draw my final breath. But when we were given this diagnosis, we were given the sort of clinical, picture of what this had looked like. And the doctor said, it'll be, blindness and seizures and loss of cognitive and motor function. But, those were just words. And we went back to Chicago because it was that National Conference for Juvenile Batten Disease, because we had to meet with the doctors and find out what was going on, to look for hope. And we went in, and I remember, getting off the plane and getting on the bus to go to the hotel, and we immediately saw our first Batten's child. And, again, I'm kind of ashamed to admit this, but we didn't see somebody's beautiful child. We saw this devastating disease. And really what was happening for me, and it is a devastating disease, there's no doubt about it, but we gave in to our fear. We allowed ourselves to see only disease. We didn't see grace. We didn't see beauty in these lives. And certainly, so fear, if I had just allowed fear to take me over in that place, I would have stayed afraid. I would have stayed angry. I would have stayed depressed. But what we found as we moved through that experience, and it was brutal, it's like we saw these kids and we saw a life of darkness. And that wasn't true. That was the lie that we were allowing ourselves to see. Because with our own children, we began to sort of enter into each day and just said, okay, God, what's here for us today? How are you going to manifest yourself for us today? How do we love today? And as we gave ourselves, my wife and I, to our children, as we opened ourselves to God's love, as we opened ourselves to other people loving us, a new life opened up. And, through the very end, of course, my oldest son, John, passed away 2.5 years ago. Ben is still with us. Thank you, Lord. But we experienced such tremendous blessing and love. And I say this, and people have a hard time believing this, but I wouldn't change my life with anyone, for nothing. I've experienced just complete love and grace, and yet you would look, and some people would look at us or look at our family and say, gee, how do you do it? We're like, as though we're just cursed. and that's not accurate at all. Sometimes we see disability or see people who have disease and we go, oh, that's awful. No, there's life there if we open ourselves to that life. And that's what we discovered.
Yeah. Now, we should point out that your son was diagnosed at age 7. He lived to how old was he when he passed?
He was 24. He had just turned 24 the month before he passed.
That's a long life. That's in terms of what you would have initially possibly thought that would have been his life expectancy. And I have to point out, in the book, there's pictures of your sons. They are gorgeous kids.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the things that we talk about when we think about special needs children, is the Eunice Shriver idea of integrating these children into our communities and our cultures. It's not something that we hide. And they are a gift. And I love the fact that you talk about when your son was going, right after he became blind, legally blind, and had to go trick-or-treating, how a friend just took him by the hand and helped him go door to door. And there was a huge gift in her, but also a gift in your son in letting him have that friendship with her. I mean, there was a mutual gift to each other.
Right, right. They really shared a special love from the very, very beginning, that first day trick-or-treating together, up to the time that John passed. You know, they really had this special love. You know, it was a friendship, but it was dear. And, you know, you speak about integration, and, you know, we kind of experienced both sides of it at that point, because when John was first diagnosed, we thought at first, because the diagnosis took a while, because it's such a rare disease, but we were in a Catholic grade school because we, you know, our Catholic faith was important to us. And it quickly, as his sight was diminishing, the school was kind of like, well, I don't think we can do this. We can't accommodate. They didn't know. And we were very politely and lovingly, and I think we were angry about this for a while, but we were basically asked to leave. And we thought, gosh, why is this? Why can't we be integrated? You know, we see what a gift and blessing our boys were to other families, how they grew, not just, be, you know, that sharing a burden, but they grew as a result of John and Ben's presence. And again, long story short, and I explain this kind of more in the book, Defying Gravity. But when John got to high school years, and the disease has had, of course, progressed quite a bit, and he didn't have the capacity to work at high school level. You know, he required a full-time aide, and he was, you know, completely blind at this point. But John said, why can't I go, you know, to a school with my friends? Why can't I go to a Catholic school? And it really prompted us to say, yeah, why can't this happen? And through a series of events and questions and interviews with different schools, we ended up at Chaminade High School in out here in Los Angeles in the Valley. And the principal and then the president, you know, Brother Tom and Jim Adams said, look, let's not fear rule the day. Let's do what we can for these boys. And to this day, you know, years after John had passed through Chaminade, you know, they would say, no, John was the blessing. We experienced great blessing from the school and the community, but they would say, you've got it wrong. John was the blessing to this school, and he changed lives and hearts by his presence. And again, that's something that I think more and more is being recognized today, you know, the gift, the blessing that kids with disabilities have and bring to other people. But
absolutely,
it's a mindset, and I think our faith does a lot to help us to see people differently, to see beauty and gift rather than curse and blessing.
And how important is it for the child to be able to participate in sports and to be able to be with his peers?
Well, it, you know, for us, you know, Lori and I grew up, we were very active, athletic, you know, our dating years, we were water skiing and, you know, you know, we were both very active. And so it was important for us to sort of bring that life into our children, because it's what we knew, and we knew how much life it gave us to be active and to be out in God's creation. And so I would say, honestly, between just the love that we gave our kids and the laughter, it was that real activity, keeping them involved in life, that really kept them going, really gave them full lives. You know, and so we did all sorts of things. We found adaptive snow ski programs, you know, and they snow skied blind and wakeboarded and water skied. You know, I taught the boys to ski, and they got on VIP soccer leagues and baseball teams out here. And they were thrilled to do it, and it was a joy to witness. And so it was very important, you know. Again, it's, you know, they compete at their level, but look, if you and I, Barbara, were to go out and play tennis, we wouldn't play at the level of a professional now, but we'd still love the game, right? We'd have a lot of fun. And that's, you know, the same with kids with disabilities. They can still experience real blessing and fun despite their disability. You know, we don't have to be comparing ourselves to everybody else. And in fact, comparison is a kind of a miserable way to live, because you're always going to come up short. But different.
Exactly right. Well, and you know, one of the things I found most interesting was I saw a picture of you and your son water skiing. And I thought to myself, you know, most fathers don't have that closeness with their son as a teenager, you know, to be able to hold him in your arms and teach him how to ski.
Yeah.
There's something there that most parents will never experience with their children. So I guess the idea is, if God gives you this, there's so many things to look forward to instead of trying to be the normal, the whatever quote unquote is normal.
You know, you're exactly right. There are times, you know, that because of the disease, you know, we were forced to be close, literally, and you know, in so many other ways, we were forced to be close, to hold hands while we walked, or to walk arm in arm, or, you know, I mean, I provided, you know, I'm the primary caregiver for the boys, especially as they got older, because I had to do a lot of the lifting, and Lori couldn't do a lot of that. But even just to help them with the, you know, bathing and everything else, you'd think, oh, isn't that terrible? No, it wasn't. It's like when you really get in there and you're close physically and you care for somebody. You know, I think of Jesus and you know, the Mary washing his feet and Jesus washing his disciples' feet. That closeness, that bond, this, you know, physical touch is so important, and we thrive with this. And again, because of the disability, that was one of the things we had to remain close, and we did, and that was a blessing. I did have to grow in closeness, you know, where the natural progression of a teenager and adolescent is to move further away. We couldn't do that. And I think there's that metaphor, too, that our relationship with God, we think we grow in independence and, oh, God, I've got this. You don't need to be close. And it's not true. You know, our lives don't prosper as we move away from God. You know, our lives prosper and we find healing and wholeness as we continue to move toward God. And that was, again, it's kind of a complicated, you know, difficult to explain right now, but that's what we experience, and that's what I recognize in my own faith. Is so often I think, oh, I've got this, Lord. You know, you don't have to be so close. And I think he just looks at me and laughs and goes, yeah, that's what you think.
We're speaking with Joe Sikora. The book is called Defying Gravity: How Choosing Joy Lifted My Family from Death to Life. You know, we often think that we've got this all figured out, our lives are normal, and yet, you know, you point out in the book there was a close friend of yours whose son committed suicide, and how tragic the loss of her son was so unexpectedly, that really when you go through life, there are so many crosses that we just can't really escape them.
Right. You know, and that's, you know, look, our journey, or our cross, if you will, or is, you would think, somewhat unique, because juvenile Batten disease is unique. I mean, most doctors have said, what is it? Yeah, I think I remember the name of it. But you and I, we are all going to face loss and death and struggle. And that's, you know, that's why I think the story, why it was so important for me to share it. It's not about my journey with this disease. It's that more universal story. It's what I found as I was sharing the story. I thought, yeah, everybody's going to suffer. Everybody's going to face their own death. And I thought, you know, the gift, if you will, and that's maybe probably not the best word to use, but I was forced, my wife and I were forced very early on to look and to consider our mortality, because we saw our kids, you know, and the diagnosis and the prognosis is, hey, you guys don't have a long time. And so I was always coming back, what matters? What's important? And I think that's the same question that we should all be asking, is we are all just passing through, and it's going fast. I mean, you know that, you see that, you know, the years just go faster and faster. And I think the more that we can come to this place and say, okay, God, what is it all about? What really matters? Where do I find meaning? That's when we find joy, when we really open ourselves up to God's answers. You know, it's like, well, this is what it is, and this is what it is. And it's frequently very different than what we think. You know, again, to go back to one of your earliest questions, it's like, I thought I was supposed to be an actor. You know, well, I had to let go of that. And it was the best thing in the world for my own soul. And for my life, it's like, no, I've got to let God define me and give me the path. And that's, you know, one of the real themes that I explore in the book.
Joe, how important was your spiritual life, you and Lori's spiritual life, and how there might be some people listening who are also experiencing crosses and say, you know, he must have come through that better than I. I really struggle day to day. I, you know, there's some days when I really resent this and I just feel overwhelmed by it. How important is it in those moments, or what do you do in those moments? Did you have those moments, and how did you get through?
Yeah, look, there is nothing wrong with struggling, with wrestling with our faith. I mean, you know, I continue to do it. I look at it every day. My faith is everything. You know, I mean, I was born Catholic and raised Catholic, and my wife was raised Baptist. You know, she later on into our marriage became Catholic. But, you know, faith is really born. Real faith is born in the fires of adversity. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we don't wrestle, when we don't struggle, when we just try to entertain or distract ourselves with life. I mean, real faith is that, you know, turning and picking up the cross and following. I don't think God is offended when we say, gee, I'm not feeling it today, you know, or I'm really struggling today. You know, I think God really, I don't want to say God has the opportunity. God can do anything, obviously. But when we are forced to our knees, as the Apostle Paul says, I would say this, you know, when he had his thorn in the flesh, whatever that was, Paul was sort of pushed to his knees. And his response is, that's exactly where I needed to be. You know, God enters into our struggle more. I think we look around and we can find God more in our struggle than when life is good. And so, again, struggle or hardship or cross is a gift. If we see it, if we say, okay, how now can I grow in my faith? You know, I think that's the story of Job, really. Job was a good man who lost everything, and his friends tried to give him the easy answer, saying, well, Job, you did something wrong. Just turn and repent, and life will be good. And that wasn't the answer. It's like, you know, they didn't understand, you know, the suffering. They didn't understand the loss. You know, Job's friends gave him bad advice and steered him incorrectly. And the reality is, suffering and struggle and cross and hardship is where we can meet God. So although I think we can struggle with it and go, boy, I'm not doing this very well, you just got to stay in there and say, okay, God, I'm not doing this very well. And allow him to move in into our lives in that struggle. So I think we really do ourselves a disservice when we try to run from hardship or difficulty.
I agree. Now, we also talked about in the book how important community was, and your Catholic faith as community. We referenced the Chaminade High School and the ability of the discernment to integrate children who are different and make it diverse and have them participate as fully as they can in a regular kid's life, a high school child's life. But how important was community for you in terms of the spiritual uplifting, the physical meals made, the support that you received? I mean, we're not meant to do this alone, right?
Right. Now, I agree. We are not made to do this alone. You know, at the very beginning, God created right man, and he said, oh, you don't do this very well alone, you know, and he created woman, right? The whole idea is relationship, and it was difficult, quite honestly. It was humbling for us because we both saw ourselves, Lori and I, as capable people. We are comfortable in the role of giving to others. It was more difficult for us to accept love because it was very humbling, because we had to recognize and come to grips with our own weakness and our need. And yet, that was what really brought us life. You know, we wanted to, in a sense, we wanted to escape, you know, with this disease. We said to ourselves, we just wanted to go to some deserted island and live out our lives with our boys, you know, but we didn't have that opportunity. I don't own an island, but more importantly, we wouldn't have found healing alone or separate. It was as our community said, boy, you guys need some help, let us in. And we opened ourselves to community. Did we find life and healing? And, you know, I'm a marriage and family therapist now, and I recognize that when people are depressed, there's a tendency to isolate, which only contributes to the depression. And so most therapists, you know, would say, hey, if you're depressed, if you're struggling, you've got to push yourself to get out, to be with other people, to engage in life, because that's how we find healing. And that was our story too, is as much as we separated from life or from other people or from God, we didn't find life. But as we opened ourselves to other people, as we allowed ourselves to be loved, that's when we found healing. So community is everything. It's you know, people say, well, I've got my own faith, for instance. You know, it's like, I don't need to go to church. I don't have to go to mass because, you know, I've got my relationship with God. Well, I'm glad you do. But you're going to experience so much more of your faith as you really get out of yourself and get into the lives of other people and allow other people to get into your life. That's what community is all about. And it's a God-designed thing.
And you speak of your son, John, having that quality just from birth, right?
Yeah. John had, look, I call him St. John. I don't know that the church will ever recognize that, and it's not necessary. But John always had this angelic, giving, loving quality where he just loved other people. He just gave. He had this quietness that was very powerful, but it was a very, you know, born in humility, but he just loved contact. His favorite, even up to the very end when he was, you know, just very, you know, couldn't walk on his own, couldn't really speak. He just loved to talk or listen to people talk. He loved to be in there. He loved to laugh with his uncles and his aunts and his family and his friends. You know, if we could just hang out and he could hear the laughter of other people, he would laugh. You know, he didn't have to get the joke, but he just loved, you know, he loved people. And, you know, there was a natural, beautiful quality about that whole thing. And, you know, it's a real gift.
You also speak in the book of a woman in your community who just couldn't handle this sharing this burden. Speak to people who may feel like they can't go and share something with someone and they have to back away. How do you, as a person who needs that help, react like your wife Lori and feel like a little bit let down? And how do we, as people who may feel that genuinely that they can't do it, what advice do you give to on both sides of that issue?
You know, for us, and I, you know, I don't want to make anybody feel bad. You know, it's like I almost didn't even want to write about it. But the reality is,
it happens.
You know, some people are going to run again from the suffering. They're going to run from the struggle. And I don't know if it was the disease per se or what it was. But there are going to be some people who say, no, I don't want that to be a part of my life, who see disability or see people who are different, who see struggle. And they say, no, I don't want to bring that into my life, because I think what happens is they are faced with their own fears of mm-hmm. mortality mm-hmm. or loss, or and they don't want to be reminded of that vulnerability. And yet I would say that's really our greatest gift, is to recognize that we're vulnerable, that we have this real need. And so although it's natural to say, no, I don't want to be with the poor, or I don't want to be with that person who has cancer, or I don't, you know, sometimes we do that because we recognize, again, our own weakness or vulnerability. And yet I think the sooner that you can do that, you know, the more that you can recognize that you really need to recognize, you know, how weak we really are, the better off we are. You know, I want to share really kind of a funny story. I still laugh to this day. My son, Ben, you know, who's still with us, he's 23 years old right now. And he lamented the fact that he couldn't drive a car. John did too. I actually taught him how to drive. And I write about that. It's very funny in the story. You know, he's blind. And I had this Jeep and I took him out into the desert. And it's actually a really, really funny story. But even to this day, Ben says, I want to drive. I say, okay, Ben. And he puts his hands on the wheel while I'm driving. And sometimes, like, when he feels my hand on the wheel, because obviously he can't see. He yeah. doesn't know where he's going. The car turns, and he thinks he's doing everything. But sometimes when his hand brushes up against mine, he goes, Dad, I got this. Let go. It's like, oh, okay, Ben. Okay, you got this. And I think, boy, that's life. We're always thinking, God, I got this. Let go. And I think he continues to hold the wheel. But I think, in a sense, he just must laugh and go, oh, okay, you got this. I got it, you know. We just don't like to recognize
it. That's a great point,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that what you talked about with this idea of the fear of being around people who are different or dealing with someone suffering or working with the poor even. And that reminded me of St. Francis kissing the leper, that he was really enslaved to those fears until he actually confronted them and in a very visceral way. But do you think that is what drives the euthanasia movement in our world, and the right to die movements, that we just can't stand to see suffering, or we just don't want to enter into it?
I think both. I think one, you know, we have this idea, oh, you're suffering or you're different, you'd be better off dead. You know, we come to a really bad conclusion. You know, there's no doubt people would look at our life and say, oh gosh, you know, you should never have had those children. You know, what a horrible life, what a horrible you know, it's like, wow, so wrong. You know, my kids are happy, they laugh. Yeah, they cry just like everybody else. We all struggle. But they live with great blessing. They're very happy and joyful. And so, yeah, I think it's a part of it that we look at people suffering and think, oh, I don't want to look at that, you know, because that's me. And so let me push it out of the way, you know, and we wrongly assume that just because we're dealing with disability or loss, that we're not happy. I think a good friend of mine, he's a clinical psychologist, and he's got a Down syndrome boy. And he and I joke when we get together and we talk, and he goes, Joe, don't tell my kids, but he's my favorite, his Down syndrome boy. And he's just this wonderful kid, you know, and joyful and happy. Yeah, his life is simple, you know, but that the love that they share in that family, you know, you wouldn't look at that. And yet, you know, you see in countries, it's like, oh, we eliminated, you know, Down syndrome. It's like, what?
Iceland. Yeah, you're right. Iceland's bragging about that. And I do believe it's around 98% of all children who are diagnosed with Down syndrome are aborted. So yeah, it is the sense that we have to have somehow control our lives, have a perfect life, have a painless, cross-free life, have a life where we don't need God, where we can do everything, pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. But that never happens in reality. And this is why this book is so important. It's called Defying Gravity, How Choosing Joy Lifted My Family from Death to Life. We're speaking with Joe Sikora. One thing I wanted to ask you before we conclude the interview, because you did mention you're a marriage counselor, and I think it's so important to talk about with so many couples either not getting married or getting divorced in our culture. I think every marriage, and you point out your own, in your book, your own marriage went through this. Every marriage goes through a point at which it seems as if a split is inevitable. And there has to be a point at which you find something to keep the marriage going. Now, when you have disabled or children with disabilities, I'm sure, or any kind of cancer, or any kind of you know, financial problems, that increases all the more the tension. But it's inevitable in every marriage. Talk a little bit about what you write about in this book about your marriage.
Yeah, I think, you know, we didn't encounter anything that's so unique in our marriage. Like you said accurately, all marriages go through this, you know, almost a disillusionment phase where it's like, wait a second, this isn't what I married. Where are those passionate feelings? Where is that great desire that I had? And so love really becomes that decision. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't, I don't mean to be a downer. It's like, wait, I'm not going to feel these feelings. Well, feelings are going to come and go in everything, in every aspect of your life. You know, you're going to be really excited that you got that new job. But, you know, a couple years into it, you're going to say, it's a job. I love what I'm doing. But, you know, the feelings are going to go. And in marriage is the same thing. Feelings will come and go. It's not an accurate reflection of whether or not the relationship is meant to be. You know, when the relationship, when you don't feel those powerful feelings or that strong attraction, that's really when you're given the opportunity to grow as a person. That's when, you know, to sacrifice and to give and to do the things that you don't always feel like doing. That's really when we grow. And, you know, look, most, you know, marriage, you know, the divorce rate is, you know, about 40 to 50% over the lifetime of a marriage. We don't do it well. But I think one of the reasons is because we think too much that, you know, we've got to have these feelings. And feelings are an ineffective barometer whether or not a relationship is good or not. You know, a relationship is good when you choose to love, when you choose to serve, when you choose to sacrifice. And the paradox is when you choose to do that, well, so often you discover, oh, those feelings come back. There's a deeper joy that you experience. You know, and I would equate it to this, and maybe this isn't the best example, but I'm just thinking of this as we speak. You know, the Apostle Paul in the fourth chapter of Philippians, he says, you know, I found, and I'm paraphrasing it, he says, but I found the secret to happiness, basically. I found joy. And he says, it's whether I'm well-fed or hungry, in jail or free, you know, whatever I have, I can make it through anything with the one who made me who I am. Basically, Paul is saying, you know, with God, I can experience this great joy. And we kind of make the mistake in our marriages, in our lives, thinking, if I have these things, then I'll be happy. Now, sometimes if you get the new boat, the new car, the new house, you'll be happy. But that feeling is going to disappear or dissipate. But the real joy that we find in our marriages isn't based on, you know, finding that perfect person. It's choosing to love that imperfect person. It's choosing to look around in the midst of the struggle and find God. And I think that's what Paul said. And I think that's what I discovered in my marriage, in my family, and in my life.
Very sound advice. My final question to you is, if you had control and could have chosen the life that you thought you wanted and had tremendous success in Hollywood, you were the Leonardo DiCaprio. Looking back now, can you see how shallow and how vacant that life would have been?
Yes, my life would have been a disaster. And I really think, so often we think, well, God didn't answer my prayer. Thank God, God didn't answer your desire, because I think usually our desires lead to disaster. Not always. You know, God puts things in your heart and you go, oh, this is from God, and we pursue it. But, you know, selfishly, I had a clear idea of what I wanted, and it would have been an absolute disaster for me in my life. I would not have found happiness, peace, joy, or love had I gotten what I wanted.
Interesting. I think that's a great way to close. And again, the book is entitled Defying Gravity. It's written by, we're speaking with Joe Sikora, How Choosing Joy Lifted My Family from Death to Life.
Thank you. And all the proceeds of the book, by the way, are being donated. I'm not making a cent off this book.
Oh, I think
so. It's all going to Beyond Battens to support other families and hopefully a cure someday for this disease.
I think everybody will benefit from reading this book, even if you don't have a cross in your life right now. This is just a good book to keep on your bookshelf. Somebody you know will need it. You will need it at some point in your life. These are universal truths that we all will confront. So thank you so much, Joe, for writing this.
Thank you, and God bless.
God bless.
You are listening to Walking in Faith, right here at Holy Spirit Radio, WISP in Doylestown, and WCOJ in Coatesville.
Good morning. This morning we're joined by George Weigel. He's the author of the book, The Fragility of Order. George, I want to ask you about the title of your book, The Fragility of Order. You talk a little bit about how after World War I and World War II and the end of the Cold War, and the Soviet Empire dissolving in Central Europe, that we somehow had a false sense, a naive sense, that this order was now with us, this peaceful order of the world, and that all things had been set right, and there was going to be a peaceful order marching on through history throughout the world. Talk a little bit about that.
Now, this is an American illusion, and it's something of a Catholic illusion, too. I think after the Cold War, a lot of people assumed, including President Clinton, that, you know, you could just, that international affairs would revert to a kind of stable situation like the latter part of the 19th century. That's just not the way the world works. Americans, I think, also had gotten the impression that the order in our republic was self-maintaining. And we certainly should have been disabused of that idea over the past several years. And then there's the Catholic illusion that order in the church is self-maintaining, which under the present cultural circumstances is something of a fantasy, too. I should underline that by order here, I don't mean the same old over and over again. I mean, moving into the future, guided by stable reference points. That's true order. It's a dynamic idea, not a static idea. But keeping those stable reference points in place and vital requires work. So what this book is about is exploring how in world politics, American politics, and the church, that order has gotten a bit rattled in the past quarter century. Because I think understanding how that happened is the prerequisite to doing something useful about it.
As you mentioned, all three of those things, the politics, the world, and religion, are all intermingled. This is what this century really played out. All the various experiments of man trying to find the perfect system, the perfect order.
Well, a constant theme of my work for the last 35 years has been to try to read history, American history, and world history through a theological lens, which is to say, in some respects, a cultural lens. This is an art that has gotten a bit lost in the world of political science, which too often becomes a kind of statistics game. But I think with John Paul II, who was a master of this, that to read history in its true depths is to read the deep cultural currents that that shape history. And as I tried to show in that essay on not so much why the First World War happened, but why it continued, why did this mass slaughter continue for 3 years after it was clear that there was going to be no quick resolution of this, that some very bad ideas in European high culture and politics in the late 19th and early 20th centuries contributed to a situation where Europe really came close to self-destruction. And I think the jury is still out on whether the effects of that were not finally lethal. A lot of what we see in Europe today, as I tried to explain in the book The Cube and the Cathedral 15 years ago, is a result of the exhaust fumes of World War I. So that kind of a theological reading of history, I think, is something I can bring to the table of public conversation, and I hope this book does that.
So many of the isms that played out in the 20th century seem to be man's struggle to find a perfect order apart from God. And we see this today continuing in the atheistic and secularist cultures that pervade society. What's your take on that?
Let me go back to that book, The Cube and the Cathedral, which I wrote in the early part of this century, and which happily is still in print. In that book, I explored what Father Henri de Lubac, one of the great theologians of the 20th century, called the drama of atheistic humanism, of which Karl Marx was one exponent, but certainly not the only. And according to this body of thought, the God of the Bible is the enemy of human freedom and maturation. And so you have to throw the God of the Bible over the side if humanity is going to move forward, mature, and liberate itself for a brighter future. This proved to be utterly disastrous in Europe, beginning with the First World War, continuing with the rise of the European totalitarianisms, fascism, Nazism, and communism. And the after effects of that are still visible today. In a secularized Europe that is literally depopulating itself. There isn't a single country in the European Union today that has a replacement level birth rate. This is the first time in human history that there has been such a willful, massive depopulation. There have been depopulations before, but they've been caused by famines or plagues or, you know, natural disasters or wars. This is self-induced. It's actually a very good example of what Pope Paul VI meant by the contraceptive mentality or a contraceptive culture. But at the bottom of the bottom line, it goes back to this abandonment of the God of the Bible, whose first commandment, of course, is be fruitful.
You talk in the book about communism, certainly as it manifests itself as an atheistic viewpoint of man without God. After World War II, under Pope Pius XII, there was a fairly stern approach to those who collaborated with communists in their own countries. There was automatic excommunication. Following Pope John Paul XXIII, there was an easing of the relations with these communist countries. Talk a little bit about what you write about in your essay about this in your book.
Well, what John the 23rd and Paul the 6th tried to effect was what they called a modus non moriendi, a way of not dying in communist-dominated countries. It was well-intentioned. It was an attempt to find some measure of possible cooperation at the level of social and cultural life. But it ultimately did not work in Central and Eastern Europe. And in fact, I think all of the evidence is that the Ostpolitik, this attempt to find some way of not dying with communist regimes, backfired. As I demonstrated in the second volume of my biography of John Paul II, The End and the Beginning, this Ostpolitik, as it was called, pretty much destroyed the Catholic Church in Hungary. It drove the real Catholics almost completely underground in what was then Czechoslovakia. And it caused a lot of unnecessary headaches for the church in Poland, which, led by the primate Cardinal Stefan Wyszyński and the Archbishop of Krakow, Karol Wojtyła, who would become Pope John Paul II, was the strongest church behind the Iron Curtain, and therefore in a better position to resist the pressures of the communist regime. But this is an ongoing debate, as you know. There's discussion now about reaching some sort of arrangement with the communist regime in China on the appointment of bishops. I've written in my weekly Catholic Press column on several occasions that I think this is a very bad deal that's being proposed. I don't think the Chinese state or the Chinese Communist Party should have a role in the appointment of bishops. But it's a constant discussion. How does the church live in these situations of massive repression and persecution? So far in the 20th century, I think the evidence is that the way you live is by resisting. That's certainly the lesson from Poland. And while not every place is Poland, there's something to be learned, I think, from that experience.
You also talk about the two synods on the family that took place in 2014 and 2015. What can we learn from that?
Well, I discuss the synods of 2014 and 2015 in this book, The Fragility of Order, and I hope that discussion my readers will find useful and helpful in understanding what was really going on there. I think there's actually a different argument involved in the question of marriage, Holy Communion, etc. And that's the question of whether Catholic light, as I've called it for almost 20 years now, is a viable proposition in the 21st century world. a kind of dumbing down of the faith, often in the name of good things like, you know, compassion and outreach and accompaniment and so forth. But it seems to me that all of the evidence, the empirical evidence, is that Catholic light is uninteresting. People don't buy it. You know, why should they? I mean, it's a kind of cotton candy Catholicism. And in today's cultural circumstances, it seems to be the case that the Catholicism that can not only survive but flourish is Catholicism in full. It's the magisterium of John Paul II and Benedict XVI, understood as the authentic interpretation of Vatican II. That's what's living in the church in the United States, in Africa, in some parts of Europe, etc. And where the church is dying, it's where the Catholic Light Project continues to be pursued against all the evidence that it's really a terrible failure.
Does the church have to make a similar stand against the secularist culture?
Well, let me make two points on that. One is that the job, as I understand it, is not to resist the culture, it's to convert the culture. The options are not acquiescence or appeasement on the one hand and, you know, fleeing into the hills in a resistance movement on the other. The job is to convert the culture. Secondly, Ross Douthat is a friend of mine. He and I have discussed these things for years. I think he's wrong. I think the living parts of the church, as I just said, are the parts that have embraced the magisterium of John Paul II and Benedict XVI as the authentic interpretation of Vatican II. And those parts of the church will continue to live and grow. The parts of the church that continue to try to make Catholic light work are going to continue to die. So I don't think, I think the confusion of the present moment is entirely unnecessary and counterproductive to the new evangelization. But I don't think its long-term effects are as potentially dire as what Ross Douthat
thinks. He's pretty much thinking schism, I think.
Well, I don't know where that's going to come from. Who's leaving?
Yeah.
I mean, who's leaving? The Catholic left learned a long time ago that if you leave the Catholic Church, nobody pays any attention to you. So that's not going to happen, at least deliberately on that side. And I'm not going anywhere. I'm not. And the people I think I speak for and represent aren't going anywhere. So I don't. What you have is a kind of de facto, I've called it in the past, psychological schism, in which people have decided that they are simply not going to believe and practice what the Catholic Church believes and thinks we should practice, but they're remaining, at least formally, in full communion with the Church. This is something new. It's not edifying, but it leads to dying local churches. This is exactly what's going on in the German-speaking parts of the Catholic Church today, in Germany, Austria, and the German cantons of Switzerland. Psychological schism leads to ecclesiastical death. And that, again, is an example of the failure of the Catholic Light Project.
Now, you did a sweeping overview of the last century in your various essays in this book. I was curious as to, and if you had any thought of putting in Fatima and the Divine Mercy message. And I sort of see those as two insertions from heaven into the century. How do you read those in light of everything that you've written about history?
Well, there has been an awful lot written about Fatima and Divine Mercy, so I suppose I don't feel any need to add to the to the list. I think with John Paul II that the experiences of Sister Faustina, Saint Faustina, were a God-given response to the cultural crisis that I describe in the first chapter of this book, in the essay on the First World War, and how that and what came after it tore great holes in the moral fabric of humanity. And the answer to that was given in this experience of the divine mercy that has really become the perhaps the chief devotional practice of the Catholic Church today. So
a major part of Pope Francis's pontificate, really.
Well, it yes, but all of that is building on what was done by John Paul II.
Absolutely.
It was John Paul II who canonized Faustina as the first saint of the third millennium. It's John Paul II who declared the octave of Easter, Divine Mercy Sunday. So the notion that Pope Francis has invented this notion of God's mercy being a primary message of the Church is a media fantasy. What John Paul II did, in a very powerful way, was link God's mercy to God's truth. The divine mercy enables us to see the truth about ourselves and to live in that truth. And you can never divide the two. Mercy is not sentiment. Anyone who reads the diaries of Faustina knows that mercy is not sentiment. It's a very powerful experience of divine cleansing, if you will, and that is to enable us to live in the truth.
Do you think the American experiment can be successful when it loses its moorings from a Judeo-Christian tradition and heritage and moral worldview?
The short answer is no. The more complicated answer is the rebuilding of America, as I suggest in the essay in The Fragility of Order called A New Great Awakening, is going to be a job for all people who believe in living in the truth, living in the moral truths that are inscribed in our persons and in the human condition. These are truths that we can know by reason. Thomas Jefferson understood that when he talked about self-evident truths in the Declaration of Independence. Now, I happen to think the shortest and easiest path to grasping those truths and living in them is through faith in the God of the Bible. But that's not the only path to grasping those truths necessary for public life and living in them. So what we need is a coalition of people committed to living in the truth of the dignity of the human person and all that that implies. And yes, I think it's entirely possible to give America a new birth of freedom, rightly understood, through a coalition of people willing to live in the truth. I think Western civilization is in real trouble. If there's only your truth and my truth and nothing that either one of us recognizes as the truth, then when our two truths come into conflict, there's no standard by which we can settle the argument about who's right. So either you impose your power on me or I impose my power on you. This is what Benedict XVI meant by the dictatorship of relativism. It's alive and well throughout the Western world, and it's a real danger to a democracy. We saw that in the Little Sisters of the Poor case in the United States. There are many examples of this in Europe and Canada. And the way we're going to fix that problem, to go back to where we were just a moment ago, is by a new great awakening to the moral truths that make democratic civilization, not only democratic politics, possible.